The following podcast is a presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Welcome to Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius, your source for horror, sci-fi, suspense, and all things violent.
Hey, what's up, guys? Thank you so much for joining me today on Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius. Today we have episode 63. At the end of it, we will play Ain't No Messiah, chapter 10. Hopefully you guys have been enjoying that story. That is out now. Wherever you buy audiobooks, it should be out. And you could do that, or you could listen to it a chapter at a time here for free. I just spent the last, well, not the last 6 hours, but this past week, I spent 6 hours listening to Untold Mayhem. Whenever you get an audiobook done, you need to listen to it carefully to make sure there are no mistakes, no retakes. Out of all 24 stories, there were absolutely none that I could catch, which is awesome. Usually there are a bunch. And what's really cool is on this one, it's a multicast. There are 9 different narrators, and they do an incredible job making each of the stories sound unique and different. So I'm very excited about that. If you remember me talking about Untold Mayhem before, I was never super excited about this collection. I kind of doubted it a lot, but reviews have been good. And listening to the stories like this, I enjoyed them so much more. So now I'm pretty excited about it. I'm way more excited about the audiobook than I am the ebook and the print, but pretty cool. Another really cool thing that just happened is Eddie Bravo had a chance to watch my TBI video that I shared last week, the traumatic brain injury video. He thought it was pretty powerful, so he put it out. I've had a lot of views on it, getting a lot of cool responses from people. It's kind of sad too, a lot of sad responses, because you see how many people have these issues and then maybe don't have the means to pay for the treatments that I found effective. But the good thing is, I believe all those treatments are going to get cheaper. I think more and more medical professionals are realizing the importance of treating TBIs and how much of an effect they can have on our brain health. I just picked up a book right now by, started reading it today, The End of Mental Illness by Dr. Amen. Dr. Amen's one of the doctors that I wanted to get a brain scan with. I still might. I'm not sure. Whether or not I do, I would like to talk with him. But it's a very interesting book so far. I just started reading it this morning. Got it yesterday. And hopefully I'll have a chance to talk with Dr. Amen for my book, for my brain book, before I finish writing it. That is what is next up on my list. I have, well, so my current writing routine is, I just finished up, well, I'm finishing up Beyond Brightside, going over some edits right now. That's a slow little process. Every time the edits come in, I'll go over them. So it doesn't take up a lot of time. I'm also trying to get pages back to Steve Montgomery. He gave me his first 2 chapters of Try Not to Die Super High. Really good job. It's not going to take much to make those perfect. And then I have all of Try Not to Die in the Pandemic. John Palisano gave me 47,000 words or so, and now it's my turn to go through and completely try to put my little spin on it. So I haven't had a lot of free time to do that, but my kids and wife are going to be going to Arizona for about 4 days. I'll have the entire house to myself. So all I am going to be doing is knocking that out. Hopefully I'll be able to knock that out and get some other work done, because I really do want to start arranging my thoughts on the brain book. I've already written the first maybe 8 chapters or so, and they've already been edited. So I'm pretty happy with that. I just have to continue. So on that one, it's probably going to be a much shorter book, and maybe, I don't know. So maybe I'm already halfway done. I'm not sure, but I want to start cleaning up my thoughts on that. And then as soon as I get that in pretty good shape, I would like to jump into The Bridge. That is the next one that I'm going to have to do. So that's what's been going on with that. Not much else at home, although I did just get an electric guitar. It's pretty awesome. I asked around, my friend recommended I get a Dean, and so that is what I picked up. Having a lot of fun trying to learn that, way better than acoustic. Acoustic was fun. I'm glad I learned a lot on it, but I definitely enjoy playing the electric a lot more. And what's super cool is we also got my son an electric drum kit, just one that's a tabletop version nice and small, not too loud, but we are doing music together now. So every day we have to do, how many songs are we doing, Jake? Six or seven? Yeah, so we're doing like six or seven songs a day together. I'm on guitar and he's on the drums. We're getting pretty good at TNT by AC/DC. Yesterday we were practicing some Slayer, and then he really enjoys Panic at the Disco. So try to make it to where we can play stuff that we like. Oh, but his favorite drumming is Skillet right now, Invincible. That's his song. So I'm encouraging it. And today we might even try to get my daughter to sing. She enjoys singing, not in front of other people so much, but today I think we'll get her to sing for our little band. So yeah, that's pretty much it. Not a whole lot going on, just trying to stay busy, trying to stay productive as much as possible. And I wanted to check in here and at least share chapter 10 of Ain't No Messiah. So let's go ahead and wrap this thing up. Hope you guys have a fantastic week. Hopefully you are getting out of your lockdown situation, staying safe, staying sane, all that good stuff, staying positive. All right, guys, hope you guys enjoy this chapter, and I will talk to you next week. Peace.
Chapter 10. It's getting late. The sun directly over the mountains to the west. If I squint and look to the right of the MGM, I can just make out the tiny patch of green, the shadow of the mountain starting to swallow it. That's where I just came from, saying a final goodbye, saying I'm sorry. Nah, this shit isn't what I wanted. None of this. The billion plus followers, the millions of dollars, it's just numbers. I'd trade it all. I empty my glass and fill it back up, promise myself I won't get too trashed. I flinch at movement on top of the Monte Carlo. I wait for the gun, for the sniper that will finally do it. Use a special bullet that'll punch through this glass and erase my brain. There's several guys up there, but they're just pushing something off the edge. A huge white banner drops the length of the building. Charles, 316. Bigger than I've ever seen. I turn my back to the window, head to the pulpit. This book right here was Father's gift to Lily. I never read it until now. Figured there wasn't much point since I'd heard every one of those stories from Father's very lips. All except the last chapter, the final passage, the last word. I hate to admit it, but his Bible's not half bad. If it weren't about me, maybe I'd even buy one. At least that way I wouldn't have to think about the inscription every time I see the damned thing. The book goes on the altar next to the tiny black box with the red button so I can use both hands for the pulpit's monitor. The screen comes to life, the almighty Charles Campbell standing outside the entrance, a phone number big and bold at the bottom, four lines of fine print below it. Father looks fabulous, thanks to his fake tan, private trainer, and enough money to gloss over every flaw. But I've got the TV muted because I can't listen to what he's saying. The red message flashing across the screen gives me a pretty good idea. Voting now open. Shit is in motion. Action is what Jeremy'd say, but only if he wanted you to know he was filming. Father smiles like everything's grand, that nothing was sacrificed for this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. For him, this is bigger than big. Then a day that goes by that I don't wonder what my life would have been like if I'd listened to Father and been content with my life. If I had a little faith and just believed, maybe things would be different. But I kind of got the feeling it wouldn't have mattered. We'd all end up in the same place. 47 floors up, the entire world waiting and watching. I'll vote before it's over, so at least I can have a say, no matter how insignificant. My legs can't hold me up like they used to. So I head back down to my throne and pick up the bonus edition of Lost Gospels. Lily got this one for her third birthday. In Father's eyes, it's never too early to learn about the fiery depths of hell, how God's just waiting to push in every son of a bitch that doesn't believe. He hadn't cut any corners on this copy. Issue number one, bound in black leather. I just sold it for $920,000, which already cleared my bank. Close to $1 million for a book that's in perfect condition except for two pages. There's only one page that's been altered, and that's the first one. There are two lines of typeset at the top, the rest of the page filled with Father's perfect penmanship, the curves so tight, the loops so little. 8 lines of the stuff, but all it really says is how great I am, how lucky she was to have me as her father. He even signed it, Love, Grandpa. With a quick rip, one page becomes two. I don't care if it could have earned me another 100,000 if I'd left it in. No one else gets to see it. I light the blood-red candle from the altar, the flick of the lighter flaring pain at my fingers, my forearm, and the constant ache at the back of my brain. The smell of cinnamon and burnt memories fill my box. The paper's gone, another thing of the past, the Bible ready to be shipped off. Maybe I'm not the Messiah, but I'm a man of my word, so I take another pill and down it with some Jack. I force myself up and take the Bible with me into the main church, holding on to the railing to get down the staircase. At the bottom, I walk over to the elevator and push the button for my sleeve mic. Troy, it's coming down. See the courier gets it immediately. Troy says he will, which means he will. He was there when they carried me out of the rubble. He's a true believer. Chapter 11. Paul said it was dark. He'd never been out this time of night. If I'd have showed him even the least bit of fear, Paul would have turned tail and jumped back through the window. But I whispered it was okay and told him to follow. The lights were off in Mother and Father's room. I buttoned up my denim jacket, tiptoed toward the barn, and waved for Paul. I wondered what he saw when he looked at that barn's open mouth. Was he worried there were demons within? Men that killed wives, wives that killed babies, young boys with machine guns shooting anything that moved. That was the world I was leading him into. We walked to the corner past the barn. I didn't really believe anyone was listening, but before we scaled the wall, I asked God to watch over us. I pulled my lantern out from my hidey hole. I turned it on and handed it to Paul, the light barely half of what it used to be. Paul said, "What's that?" He was talking about the two pieces of paper that'd been below the lantern. I unfolded them and got close beside him. Jeremy said they were in case I ever grew some balls. Maps? First one included a half page of instructions underneath a small map. Yeah, this one's to Georgia. The other one was a black and white overhead photo featuring a blue squiggle highlighted with yellow marker. And this one's to the bus stop. Is that the top of our house? I thought he would have been more impressed. Pretty crazy, huh? Anyone could do that with their smartphone, he said, talking like he'd actually ever held one. We're wasting the batteries. I pointed him toward the trees. We're headed straight through there. Paul didn't move. It's the safest way, I said. You got to trust me. Paul said he did and led the way, listening to my directions as I guided him through the trees along the back of Jeremy's property. The lights were off inside the house, no last glimpse of Danielle. We came out on the road and headed up the hill. Since the lantern was almost dead, we turned it off and put it in my bag. The light from the moon and a few street lights at the top of the hill were enough to see where we were going. I said, "Okay, rule number one. Stay behind me to the right, always watching our back, and I'll keep lookout. There are people out here that'll run you over and just keep on going. It happens all the time." We got to the top of the hill and looked down. Paul said, "I forget it's so small." I'd only been to town a few more times than Paul, but Jeremy's pictures and papers had put everything into perspective. I marched us down, told him to act like we belonged, both of us glad no one was driving around. Paul pointed out the church's electronic billboard that Father always complained about, the one we paid for since it was my head that broke the old one. I didn't care to look, so Paul read it. "An open mind is a dangerous thing. Your brain might fall out." Sounding dead serious, he whispered, "Should we break it?" It was nice knowing I wasn't the only one with stupid ideas, but that wasn't the kind of guidance I needed. I ignored him and took us down Main Street. The map said the address we wanted was 107, but it was just a small liquor store, a bench with a roof over it, dark on the sidewalk. Paul asked, "What's wrong?" The only two vehicles in the parking lot were the dirty brown Camaro and a big red Ford Bronco with no roof, just a front windshield. I don't see the buses. Paul pointed at the liquor store where at least 20 signs were posted in the windows, half of which were blinking on and off. I read the handwritten one on the door. Bus tickets sold here. We went inside, the automatic door closing behind us. The round-faced man standing behind the counter said, "Gotta leave those by the door." The only things we were holding were our bags, so we set them down and the door reopened. The man put both his hands on the counter, smoke from his cigarette rising in front of his face. "You boys retards?" I said, "No, sir." He shook his head and pointed next to the door. "Right there." Paul piled his bag on top of mine. "Look at all the stuff they got." The store had three aisles filled with everything you'd ever need and a bunch of stuff I'd never seen. Paul said, "All that food." Neither one of us had had any dinner, so I told him, "Go ahead and grab some batteries, too." The white door at the end of the aisles banged open, and out came a man with a dirty gray beard, sporting a red flannel shirt and a lawnmower driving across his hat. He crumpled up a paper towel and tossed it in the trash can, took the stool at the end of the counter across from the worker puffing away on his cigarette. Paul went down the aisle, and I approached the man behind the counter, keeping clear of the cloud of smoke. "Excuse me, sir, I'd like to buy bus tickets." "Where are you headed?" I told him, and he grabbed the brown folder. He flipped it open, ran his yellow fingernail down the page. "Joshua, look at this." Paul stood in front of a machine with blue and red stuff swirling behind the small windows. "It's frozen. They got cherry." The counter guy said, "What time you looking at?" "Got 8:20, 11:20, 2:20. 11:20 tonight? "Jesus, kid." The guy on the stool put his cup to his lips and spit out something dark. "Relax, Bud." Bud took a long drag and blew it out at me. "First one anywhere runs through here at 7 in the morning, last one at 6. "Well, we can't wait that long." He shrugged his shoulders. "Guess you're shit out of luck." The guy with the beard finished his drink and crushed a can on the counter. "Mike could catch one over in Columbia, run through there all day." "Where's that?" Bud hocked up a loogie and spit it in the trash can. "Save your breath, Dusty." Dusty waved Bud off. "You ain't from around here, are you?"
"No, sir."
He threw a thumb over his shoulder, "about 70 miles that way." Paul ran up beside me, arms crossed, to hold his pile, a giant plastic cup in each hand. "Got you blue raspberry." I said, "Fine." I wondered how long it would take to walk that far. He put everything on the counter, then picked up the bag of bread. Heavenly Host cinnamon raisin. "They got pumpernickel and sourdough, too." Bud ran items across the counter, red numbers popping up on the little screen with each beep. Paul waited until Bud got to the bread. "I helped make that." Like he couldn't care less, the guy said, "That's so?" "Yes, sir. Best bread in the region." Bud squinted at the register. $33.47. Paul pulled a wad of cash out of his pocket. The stack was twice as big as mine and nearly filled his hand. He peeled off two 20s and handed them over. "Mother give that to you?" "I earned it." Bud took another drag from his cigarette, held it in for a while, blew it out on us when he handed Paul his change.
"So what you boys wanting for?"
Dusty spit a brown wad into the cup. "Easy on them, Bud. Seem like they're good kids." "That better have been your last beer." Dusty turned to us. "So you guys need to get to Columbia?"
"That's what it's looking like," I said.
"I live right by there. I could drop you off if you like." I thought I must have heard wrong. "Really? You wouldn't mind?"
"Not at all. Christian thing to do."
I stuffed the food in our bags while Dusty got off his stool and walked over to the glass doors with all the bottles behind him. From the bottom shelf, he pulled out a long red and white box and told Bud, "Put this on my tab, will you? A whole case?" He smiled so big his beard split, showed off a mouthful of yellow teeth. "Tomorrow's the Lord's Day. Gotta load up tonight."
"Well, that's a lot of loading up to do."
Dusty headed out the door.
"You know I'm good for it."
The door closed on whatever Bud said, but Dusty paid it no mind.
"Where to after Columbia?"
"Georgia." Dusty walked to the passenger side of the truck and set the case on the seat.
"What's there?"
"Family." I tossed our bags behind the back row, nodded for Paul to get in, then walked around to the other side and got in behind Dusty. Paul didn't look so sure, handing me both drinks so he could lock his hands on the bottom of his seat. He let out a squeak when the engine turned over, that roar 10 times louder than Father's. Dusty looked over his shoulder to back out the parking lot. "Ain't got no seat belts, so just hold on tight." I hadn't used one in Frank's truck, so I figured it was no big deal. Paul's arms were steel poles, his eyes riveted straight ahead. Dusty turned left onto Main and drove us away from the church, our home, our world. I snuggled into my jacket and positioned Paul's Slurpee between my feet, my hair whipping. Up ahead, a big green sign for Columbia pointed toward a loop. Dusty took it too fast, the tires squealing. We started tipping over, just a tiny bit more and we'd have been airborne. But then the wheels dropped back down and shot forward. Dusty pumped his fist in the air and shouted, "Hot damn!" The wind whipped around us. Paul leaned forward, his eyes on the instrument panel. I read his lips. 55, 65, 70. There were headlights coming at us not 5 yards away, nothing but a narrow strip of grass between the lanes. On our side, most of the lights were behind us, a couple of red ones up ahead. We were moving faster than I thought possible. My arms now clenched as tight as Paul's. No seatbelt, bodies flying through windshields. I'd seen that a bunch. That and tons of motorcycle accidents. Paul had no idea how far a body could fly, how easily parts could come off. Yet he was scrunched down in his seat praying the Lord's Prayer. God seemed pretty real right then, and I was talking to him too, but only in my head. Protect us. Protect us. Protect us. We passed a sign that said Columbia was 60 miles away, and I knew we'd never make it. Even in the dark, I could see Paul was as white as a sheet of paper, his arms shaking. I kicked his shoe and said, "Breathe." Paul looked seconds away from all-out panic, like the time I held him down and swore I'd send him to hell if he couldn't get free in 5 minutes. Eyes all big, he said, "I can't." Dusty checked his rear view, shouting so we could hear, "Everything okay?" Paul sat up a little and nodded. Dusty got over to the right lane and dropped his speed. 2 cars passed by and disappeared into the night. We had the highway to ourselves when Dusty put on his blinker and got off at the rest stop. All 10 of the parking stalls were empty. Dusty took the one at the far end, a stone's throw away from a dark river. He killed the engine and turned toward Paul. "Might want to throw some water on your face." Paul looked at the river, then leaned over to me. "I'm not going down there." Dusty laughed and got out of his truck. "Come on, I got to take a piss anyhow." Paul looked like he was still thinking about puking. I pointed at the bathroom. "Let's go." Dusty started walking. "Probably best if one of you stays with the bags." I felt dumb for not thinking about that. "Hurry up, Paul. I'll go after." Paul got out and headed after Dusty. They were inside the restroom when I heard something splash. It was too dark to see past the trees, the water's slow ripple hiding the demons. It wasn't long before Dusty came out, loud enough for me to hear. He said, "Hey, bud, your butter ain't doing so good." I jumped out of the truck and headed his way. "What's wrong?" Dusty walked right past me, like it was no big deal. He said, "He wanted you." I was just about to the bathroom when the truck started. I didn't think anything of it till Paul staggered out, hand to his nose, blood slipping through his fingers. "My money!" Tires peeled out and the chase began. I was running faster than I ever had, flying over the grass, the sidewalk, the concrete. Dusty had a head start, pulling away with our bags and more than half my money. I almost gave up, then saw the rock on the road, the moonlight sparkling on it, a sign I couldn't miss. It was smooth and solid, fit perfect in the palm of my hand. I chucked it hard, never thought I'd hit Dusty, but the thud was too wet to be anything else. He dropped out of sight as the truck weaved to the right and jumped the curb, plowed through the fence. I thought for sure he was going into the river, but then the red lights flashed on and the truck slowed to a stop. Figuring my best chance against a grown man was not letting him recover all the way, I ran for the truck. I stopped next to his door, grabbed the handle. I couldn't see him, and pictured him lying on the seat, coiled up to kick the door into me. Paul was getting close, so I threw open the door with my fists ready. Dusty was in there, his lower half slumped below the wheel, his belly caught up against it. His head was back, eyes open, staring at the roof, but not seeing a thing. There was a dark puddle on the seat where his butt should have been, and it was getting bigger, the blood dripping off the back of his head. Plop, plop, plop. Paul stopped by the back bumper. "What happened?" "This wasn't something he needed to see," I said. "Reach in the back and grab me the rope. I saw some under our bags." The puddle of blood kept growing, filled the indention, and spilled over the seat.
Paul nudged my shoulder with the rope. Now what? I took the rope without taking my eyes off Dusty's. The biggest rock you can carry, he whispered. What did we do? I turned to Paul, his battered face barely holding back tears. It wasn't you, I said. I'm the one who judged him. It's my fault, Paul said. No, I sent a wicked man to hell. Now go, get the rock. It was 7 the next morning, and I was half asleep in the back of the taxi. Paul curled up beside me, his head resting on my shoulder, bouncing every time we hit a bump. It seemed like we'd been in the cab forever. The last 4 had been endless green fields, beautiful shrubs, and enormous oak trees shading the street. Every mile we put between us and that damned rest stop, I felt better, breathed easier. Nolan, the cabbie we'd been with for the last hour, slowed down and put on his left turn signal. We sat there and waited for the long line of cars coming the other way. The tick, tick, tick of the blinker brought back the drips on Dusty's seat. I'd spilled a man's blood. The proof was on my pants and shirt now tucked inside my backpack. After a truck with a horse trailer went by, we turned onto a wide street with ranch houses on either side. 3 blocks down, Nolan pulled to the curb and said, "We're here." The house looked so peaceful, like it could have been the picture on a magazine cover. But then I saw the mailbox, all black with red letters. Hendricks. Nolan caught my eye in the mirror. "There a problem? This is what you told me." Vincent Granger was the name I was looking for. Same one Mother used to have. That's how he signed his letter, and what was printed in big black letters on the corner of the envelope. I nudged Paul with my elbow and told him to wake up. He brought his hand to his nose and groaned. Icing his nose probably would have helped with the swelling, but once I got Dusty's truck on the road, there was no stopping until we ran out of gas. Both of Paul's eyes were black and blue, his nose leaning too much to the left. "You'll be fine," I said. "Go ahead and get out." Nolan said, "Not at 4:50. This was the first time I'd stayed up all night, and I wasn't thinking clearly. "What's that?" "What you owe me." He pointed at the numbers to his right. "Read the damn meter." I hadn't known what a meter was. That's a lot of money. Nolan had both hands on the steering wheel, gripping it hard. "You saying I cheated you?" I handed him $100 in 5s and 10s. "It took me 2 months to make that." "Get a better job." Great advice, but I didn't have the first idea how I'd go about it. Seemed all I knew how to do was cut down trees and kneel still for hours. I got out of the car, grabbed my bag, and went to Nolan's window for my change. He drove away with a huff, left me in the middle of the street. Paul said, "You know what you're going to say?" "To who?" "To whoever opens the door." I walked up to the porch and knocked on the screen door, not thinking the people inside might still be sleeping. If Paul hadn't been beside me, I might have run when I heard the footsteps. It was hard to see much through the screen door, but I could make out the shape of a lady. Sounding more curious than irritated, she said, "Can I help you? Is Vincent here?" The woman made a small noise. I was about to ask again, but then she said, "Joshua?" The screen opened before I answered. It was Laura. Her eyes just as blue as they'd been 12 years before. She had on a pale yellow dress, her braided hair hanging down her back, a bright white dish towel clutched in her hand. Laura reached up and wrapped her arms so tight around me, a warmth I barely remembered. "Oh my God, you're so big." She put her cheek against mine and said, "I'm so glad you're here." I didn't know how to tell her how much I needed her right then, how I needed her touch, how I didn't want her to stop. Laura gave me a final squeeze and stood back. She held both my hands and said, "Let me look at you." Her smile looked so genuine, yet out of place on a face so much like Mother's. Same sloped nose and pointed chin, crow's feet around the eyes, and her straight teeth. This was one of the first times I didn't mind having all the attention, but I clapped my brother on his shoulder and said, "This is Paul." The smile all but disappeared from her face. "Oh, the miracle child." Paul looked confused. He didn't know the story of me calling her crazy and ruining his entrance to the world. It was never talked of in our house, and I'd been so young, who knows what I'd made up over time. But none of that mattered when Laura noticed Paul's face. "Oh my God, what happened? Are you okay?" Paul wasn't a very good liar, so I said, "A guy tried to rob us."
"You stopped him?"
"We got our money back."
"Do you want some ice, sweetie?"
Paul shook his head.
"I'm okay."
I didn't want her asking any more questions, and I was grateful to point out the thin wisp of smoke creeping up behind her. Laura said, "Oh, shit," and ran inside, called over her shoulder for us to come in. The living room was twice the size of ours and was decorated with stuffed wildlife. Two deer and a wildcat adorned the walls. The kitchen was much nicer, too. Everything brighter and more airy, with yellows and whites. Laura pulled a tray of muffins out of the oven and dumped them into the sink, fanned the smoke toward the open window.
God damn it!
The smoke tickled my throat and I stifled a cough. Laura kept on fanning and said, "Have a seat, boys. Just not the one with the armrests." There were only four chairs at the pine table. The one with the armrest was closest to the back porch. I took the seat across from it, Paul to my right by the window. Laura brought a box from the cupboard and washed out a glass bowl. She shook her head when she looked at the clock, then back at the stove, where three things were cooking. Paul asked, "Can I do that for you?" Laura stopped for a second. "You know how to bake?"
"Yes, ma'am." Paul got up like he belonged there. "Mind if I take a peek in the pantry?"
Laura showed him where it was, then tended the stuff on the stove. She took the seat to my left, her smile back, her warm, soft hand on mine.
"You're so handsome."
With all my scars and depressions topped with no sleep, she was obviously lying. I mumbled thanks and watched Paul work his magic with the mixing bowl, pouring the batter into the tray. Laura opened the oven door and punched in numbers on the screen when Paul asked her to set the timer.
She said, "That was so sweet of you."
Paul said he was glad to help, and they both returned to the table.
"How'd you boys get here?"
It sounded like there was a little bit of sorrow when she said, "Maureen's not here, is she?"
"She's at home."
Laura looked out the window. There was no mistaking the fear when she asked,
"How about Charles?"
I shook my head. "We kind of ran away." It looked like she'd been hit with something heavy.
"How kind of?"
"Not kind of at all," Paul said. "They have any idea where you're headed?"
"None," I said. "I don't even know."
She got up to pour a cup of coffee and set it in front of the special chair. After bringing each of us a water, she asked,
"So did you finally figure out they were both crazy?"
That wasn't easy to hear, but the truth never was. None of us said anything, her words just hanging in the air. Everything they told me, everything they made me believe, dismissed in one sentence. I asked, "Is Vincent sleeping?" Laura's smile disappeared.
"I'm afraid he did what you did last month."
"I'm sorry."
"Not your fault. Said there was something he had to do."
"Where?"
"California, out by Los Angeles."
The taxi had wiped out most of my money. I sipped the water and worried how much it'd cost to get there.
Laura said, "So you got his letters?"
"Only one. Seemed like a pretty nice guy." Her face looked ready to break.
"Vince is a good boy."
She didn't look ready to answer my question, so I switched to small talk about her house. I didn't remember a word she said, my mind craving sleep and the sizzling bacon. Heavy footsteps approaching the back door pulled me out of the daze. Laura hurried to the stove and said, "That's Jim." The door opened, but I couldn't see from where I was sitting. A rough voice barked, "Ronnie up?"
"Didn't you hear him last night? He got in after 3.
A sink ran on the porch.
"That isn't what I asked."
Laura brought a plate stacked with bacon, eggs, and pancakes to the table and set it in front of the coffee.
"As far as I know, he's still asleep."
The water turned off and Jim walked in, blue jeans and a green flannel, gray hair in places he wasn't bald. He went straight to the fridge.
"You can lose the attitude."
"Sorry, I just worry about him getting pulled over again."
"Drop it, Laura. He's my boy."
Jim brought out a tall glass of orange juice and headed for the table, noticed us for the first time.
"Who do we have here?"
Laura told him our names.
"These are my nephews."
He sat at the head of the table, didn't offer to shake hands.
"You two are brothers?"
I didn't know what the whole truth was, so I said what felt truest.
"We are."
Jim took a bite of bacon, crunched it up while studying us.
"I don't see it."
He spurted a puddle of ketchup onto his plate, took his knife and cut his egg, a runny yolk oozing out. As if I'd have the answer, Jim asked me, "So why did I never hear of you before?" Laura sat down. "You know I don't talk to her." Jim looked at us and smacked on another strip of bacon. "So what's the special occasion?" The timer rang and Laura got up to turn it off. She took out the muffins and set them on the stove. "They just left their home." I didn't care for Jim's grin. I explained. "It was in everyone's best interest."
"I'm sure it was," he said. "Now what? What are your big plans? You going to go strike it rich in California like Vince? Make you millions?"
Laura said, "They're just boys. They don't have it all figured out just yet. I was thinking..."
"Boys is right," Jim said. "How old are you?" he asked Paul.
"Older than my age."
Jim shook his head and told Laura, "I know what you're thinking."
She said, "I try not to ask for much." Jim continued to examine us while he finished off his eggs. Laura said, "We have the guest room. They'd be out of the way." Jim stared at me.
"You expect me to feed you, put a roof over your head? What's in it for me?"
I told him I was a real hard worker.
"What can you do?"
"Pretty much whatever needs being done." He turned to Paul.
"How about you?"
"I can help out in the kitchen."
Jim laughed. "What kind of boy wants to work in the kitchen?"
Sounding just as sure as father, Paul said, "The kind that could make you $500 a month if you let him."
"Be straight with me, boy." Paul pointed to the tray.
"Try one of those muffins. Be careful, they're hot."
Laura asked Jim if he'd like one. Jim kept his eyes on Paul as he used the tip of his tongue to push out his cheek. He took the muffin from her and asked,
"You watch him make it? How do I know he didn't slip something in it?"
I was starving and I offered to eat one. Jim said he was joking and broke it in half, the steam passing over his leathery face. He took a bite and we waited, but not long.
"You can make 500 selling these things."
"Did back home, that and bread." The other half disappeared in two bites. A guy about my age entered the kitchen without a word, walked straight to the fridge. He had the same build as Jim, the same asshole smirk. He had on blue jeans and a tight black t-shirt, barbed wire tattooed halfway around his arm. Jim took a swig of coffee and cleared his throat.
"You got a place to stay as long as you can do what you say."
"Thank you, sir," Paul said. "You won't be disappointed."
Jim said he wanted another muffin and waited for Laura to get it.
"Make it 600 and I'll give you a Ronnie's room."
The fridge slammed shut. The guy looked at Paul and said,
"Shit."
Jim sort of smiled.
"What, are you not ready to move out?"
"Not so some little homo can move in,"
Laura said. "Ronnie."
"Relax, I'm just fucking with him." Paul smiled to show no harm done. Jim got up from the table.
"How about you get busy?" he said to Paul. "The boys break for lunch at 11. I'll need about 36 of these. We'll have each of them take some home, see what people think."
Ronnie walked up to the table. The other three chairs were empty, but he pointed right at me.
"Now, how about you get your sorry ass out of my chair?"
This has been a presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.